I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to visit and speak. And I'm going to tell you about some work I've been doing with Ed Perkins for several years. There's still some things that we're trying to figure out. First, I'll tell you what the model is. And it's a model introduced by Claudia Neuhauser and Steve Pakala. And their motivation was that they wanted to see differences between stochastic models and deterministic models for things in ecology, for instance. And in fact, stochastic spatial models, that was also one of the key points. So here's their model, and I won't try to explain the name particularly. Each side of the d-dimensional integer lattice ZD will be occupied by an individual. Just call them type 0 or type 1. So right now, 0 is not empty. 0 is just the name of a type. Individuals die and get replaced. The state space is 0, 1 to the ZD. It's the set of configurations Xc. And Xc of X is just the type of the individual at site X, either 0 or 1. Okay, now the ingredients, there are two ingredients. One is a random walk kernel or probability kernel, P of X. And you may as well just think of it as nearest neighbor. We have some restrictions on it. And in their paper, it was just constant on some neighborhood set they called N, which was finite. And so that's what they did. So there's this random walk kernel, and then there are two constants, alpha 0 and alpha 1. Okay. Now, to define their model, they need the following local frequencies or densities. So in a given configuration Xc, if you take a point X, you look around you and you just see basically how many of your neighbors are of type 0 or type 1, normalized by the probability kernel. So F0 is just, in effect, the proportion of your neighbors which are type 0. F1 is the proportion which are type 1. Okay. Now here are their dynamics. Actually, they had another parameter, which I've said equal to 1 and may get to bring it in later. Well, if you're a 0, then you turn into a 1 at the rate that's up there, F1 times F0 plus alpha 0 F1. And you go to from 1 to 0 also at the indicated rate. Now, what was their motivation or what's their interpretation? Well, you can think of it as the stuff in red is death. So you have a death rate. So whether you're a 0 or 1, you die at a certain rate. And that rate has a factor proportional to your own type. That's the Fi. So that one. And then part of the rate is some multiple or proportion of the opposite type. Once you die, then you look around you and you get replaced. You might get replaced by the same type. So that's why you could think of this as just when you're replaced, that's the probability that you actually make a change. So they have these intraspecific and interspecific interpretations of these constants. Okay. And this determines, if you want to write a formal generator and all the usual stuff, a nice Markov process evolving in time. Now, there are just some comments about the mechanism. I just put the rates up there again. Of course, there are two traps, all zeros and all ones, because you can never then change into the other type. There's one special case that we know a lot about. If you set both the alphas equal to 1, then in the parentheses, you have F0 plus F1, but that has to add up to 1 because that's the proportion of zeros plus the proportion of 1s. So the stuff in the parentheses goes away, and so a 0 goes to a 1 at rate F1, and a 1 goes to 0 at rate F0. So in that case, you just choose a neighbor at random and you adopt that type. If the type is the same as yourself, nothing happens. But if it's the opposite type, then you change. So that's kind of a neutral model. And by introducing these parameters, alpha 0 and alpha 1, they get to treat the types differently. If you increase alpha 0, for instance, that tends to favor the production of 1s. It increases the rate at which a 0 will turn into a 1. So without making a formal monotonicity statement, you could expect that that would favor the 1s as you make alpha 0 larger. And conversely, if you make alpha 1 larger, that favors the 0s. For small alpha, for instance, set the two alphas equal to 0, then the rates of change of each type are the same, they're F0, F1. And that means, in effect, that you like to have the other type around you. They discovered that if you set the two parameters equal to 0, there is an annihilating dual process. And maybe I'll say something about the end. But all I want to point out is that, I should have said before that, there doesn't seem to be any nice dual process, which is the way that a lot of calculations are made with these kinds of models. So there's no kind of additive or coalescing dual. For the diagonal in the parameter space, there is this annihilating dual, but you don't really get much from it. If one writes down what the equations are, this annihilating, the existence of a dual always implies that you get convergence if you start the halves in the wrong place. If you start from Bernoulli product measure, half-half, everything symmetric, then you actually converge to something. But you don't know what the something is, and in fact, it may be the trivial mixture, half zeros and half ones, and that's not very exciting. For the most part, the existence of this dual doesn't help. So I just wanted to mention that. So you don't have the tools that you'd like to have to try to study this process. Okay, so what were their questions? They wanted to just understand parameter space in terms of several concepts and compare that with the deterministic ODE model that you could manufacture out of this. So first of all, survival of ones in particular, simply means that if you start with a single type 1 surrounded by a sea of zeros, that there's positive probability that there's always a 1. It turns out for this model that there's also a region where one or the other type takes over. So this one says that if
in their older models, they always have a lot of random marks on top.
They're older. Yeah. Okay. Well, this is. You may be thinking of some other people, but I mean that would make it a lot harder. I think. Although maybe there would be some mixing that would make it easier. But this is the one that they were interested in, and so this one says that if you have ones around, that in fact they drive out the zeros. That's just one way of saying it. And then also they were interested in coexistence. When can you have parameters such that there is a stationary distribution and invariant measure for the process for which you have both types present? All zeros and all ones are invariant measures, but can you have something where in equilibrium both types are present, happily existing together? We know completely the answers for the Vohter model, so if you set both parameters equal to 1, then you don't have survival in the sense defined, because the total number of ones in the Vohter model is a martingale. It's a fair game. You go up or down with equal probabilities. The rate depends upon the configuration. But eventually you get stuck at 0. And there's this dimension dependent behavior for the Vohter model, namely you can get coexistence for 3 or more dimensions, but not in 1 and 2. So we know what happens there. Now here's a picture that kind of summarizes a good part of what they were able to show, and that it's different enough from the deterministic picture that they were, that's what they wanted to see, whether or not there were any differences. And okay, so what is P star? In the nearest neighbor case, that's just 1 over 2D. It's actually the smallest P of X for which P of X is positive. But in the nearest neighbor case, it's just 1 over 2D. And they found these regions, look at where the ones dominate. There's a similar region upstairs where the zeros dominate, because this thing is symmetric if you interchange alpha 0 and alpha 1. The ones dominate, that's an easy comparison with something called the bias Vohter model, in which one type takes over. It just spreads out and conquers all space. This coexistence result down at the bottom, that shows you that it wasn't quite truthful. If you set both parameters equal to 0, then in fact you can use the annihilating dual if you make some assumptions on more assumptions on the kernel. And they were able to prove that for both parameters 0, you could have coexistence in a strong sense, and that means you can perturb a little bit away from there. But that's basically what they were able to show for this model. And the ODE version has those lines with slope P star, 1 over P star, being just vertical and horizontal. The coexistence region, what is the unit square? Okay, let me just first note that if you just do a little arithmetic, that's all. You can rewrite the rates this way. You replace one of the factors, F0. Oh, okay, sorry. The big stuff in the middle. Okay. So this is known, but of course this is, there's no estimates on how big it is. This is rigorous. And then up here, the zeros dominate. That's rigorous. And then up here, this is unknown. And all this stuff is unknown. Yeah, sorry. (Clears throat) Yeah, it's just this easy comparison with the bias voter model. Okay, I don't have a slide with both sets up there, but if you just you know, in the original formula, there's an F0 plus alpha F1. If you just trade in one of those, if you put the F0 to be 1 minus F1, then you just rewrite it this way. It's not anything there, and I'm not sure that it has any intuitive significance. But the reason we want to write it this way is that we want to think about this as a perturbation of the voter model. So if the parameters are close to 1, then that extra stuff, the red stuff, is small. And you have the main factors in the rates being the voter model. So that's the way we want to think of it, is that we want to look at the model close to the voter model. And we're going to do this by a comparison with super Brownian motion. And you would ask, why would we want to do that? Let me first tell you about, let me define super Brownian motion and then point out its connection with the voter model, and that's our reason for looking at this super Brownian motion idea near the voter model. Near the voter model. So super Brownian motion was defined one way last time. I'd like to define it this way because, in fact, it connects with our proofs. But super Brownian motion is the appropriate limit of branching particle systems. As the mass shrinks, the particles speed up their movement, and the branching rate increases. I like to think of this the way Klaus Fleischmann pointed out to me. If you put some of these parameters equal to 0, in particular, if you put the branching rate to be 0, well, the branching rate B comes in this martingale term. So it's 0, the martingale is 0. So in fact, nothing's random. It's just heat flow. Well, okay, if you set G equal to 0 as well, then you've just got the first term with the sigma squared. And if X0 is deterministic, then it's just, you're taking some initial, of course, it was said last time, the super Brownian motion is a measure value process. So X is a measure value process. And X of phi is just the integral of a function phi with respect to that measure X. Okay, so you take a test function, you integrate it with respect to the measure. And if the branching rate is 0 and say the growth rate is 0, then this just takes the initial distribution of mass and spreads it out with heat flow. That's all it does. The G there, if it's non-negative, is either exponential growth or exponential decay factor. And if you set sigma squared equal to 0, so that there's no motion, and what comes out takes, you have to do a little work, but then it's just Feller's branching diffusion. The total mass, there's no movement of the bits of mass, and they just sort of fluctuate. Every little bit of mass gets to 0. It's a critical branching process. Okay, so that's my view of super Brownian motion, and okay. The reason why we think of that in the context of this model is that we had earlier looked at the voter model itself and done what you do to branching systems, namely you scale space I didn't mention that before, you speed up time and you decrease the mass of particles. So one way to write that is the way I've done it. For a given n, you're speeding up time by putting this n here in the rates. That makes things change faster. There, of course, is the space scaling. And then I'm allowing n prime not necessarily to be different than n. The normal critical branching random walk approach is to make this an n. But possibly it's different. And in fact, we have to do something different in d equals 2. You may want to just not think about d equals 2. Think about d equals 3, for instance. Okay, so we proved, Ed and Rick Durrett and I proved that, in fact, when you rescale the Bode model the way I indicated, let me just go backwards to make it clear that what we're doing here is we're putting everywhere there's a 1 in the process, you put a unit, a mass of size 1 over n prime. So that makes it a measure-valued object. So we're just replacing the 1. With the small masses. And when you do this, it turns out that that thing actually converges to super Brownian motions, and you can identify the parameters. And so we knew that before. And so one thing to point out about this is that this is a low density limit. If you think of the case, say, this is supposed to be d over 2 here. The total mass of this thing is basically, think of three dimensions. So the mass scaling is 1 over n. We're starting off with a finite amount of mass. And so the mass starts off with about size n, and it tends, as time evolves, to stay about n. Now, the spatial scaling is square root of n. So in three dimensions, how much mass, the number of particles that could be in a unit cube is n to the d over 2. So I have n to the 3 halves here and n. So that means we're starting off with configurations in which there are relatively few ones. It's not a hydrodynamic kind of scaling. It's a very sparse situation. You're seeing how the ones do, mostly surrounded by zeros. Okay, so what do we do with Lotka-Volterra? So the program has two steps. And the first step is to try to prove that when the parameters are close to 1-1, so you're close to the Bode model, that some scaled version converges to super Brownian motion. And identify the parameters if you can. And then hopefully to go backwards. So to, if one knows the parameters of the super Brownian motion, then, you know a lot about it. In particular, if the growth parameter is positive, the mass just grows exponentially. It grows very well. And so if the our particle system tracks the super Brownian motions and they have a positive growth rate, then perhaps the Lotka-Volterra system has a positive, can survive. And to me, this seems an interesting point, that we're perturbing away from the Bode model where there's no survival, but we are going to get survival nearby. Okay, so we're going to use the same mass scaling as for the Bode model. Again, think of d greater than or equal to 3. And we speed up the rates again by this factor of n, and I've just put the n times the alpha minus 1 in this way, so that this is going to be of order 1, and that's going off infinity at rate n. And you make a measure value process the same way, and I'm anticipating a couple of constants here, which I may or may not be able to define for you, depending on time. But we get the following theorem. It's the same. It includes the Bode model theorem. If the thetas are 0, that's the Bode model case. But we can allow them not to be 0. And so if the alphas are approaching 1 at that fast of rate, then these systems viewed as measure-valued processes converge to super-Brownian motion. Okay. The residue of the alphas are these thetas, and they appear in the growth rate. And then there are these constants that come in, and at some point I hope I can show you a picture that defines them. That's the easiest way to do it. But we can prove this, and we have some expression for these constants. Okay. If you have that, then, all right, the super-Brownian motion grows rapidly. I mean, if it gets going, it might die out if you start from a finite mass. But if it gets going and the growth parameter is positive, then it just, the mass grows exponentially. It's a supercritical branching process, the total mass. That's all. Now, what was this growth rate? It had this form, theta 0, theta 1, and what were the thetas? They were n times the difference between our rates and 1. Right? And okay, so what does g bigger than 0 correspond to? So it's this, it's that stuff up there bigger than 0. You can factor the n out, rearrange it. And if you want this g to be 0, bigger than 0, then this corresponds to an inequality involving the alphas. And it turns out that it's the region that is below a line through 1, 1. And the slope is given by the ratio of these parameters. So that's okay, so that's just the calculation. So that suggests that the survival region near 1, 1 should be the region below some line if you're close enough to 1, 1. It's just what it suggests. There is a difference here between 2 and 3 dimensions, which is kind of unfortunate, as you'll see. This slope is less than 1 in dimension 3 and more and equal to 1 in dimension 2. All right, so here is the picture of a theorem that comes out of what we can get. And I'm not telling you how you go from the super-Brownian motion back to the Lotka-Volterra process. Briefly, that involves comparison with oriented percolation. It's this kind of technique or machine invented by Jurett and Bramson. We have troubles applying it because we can't calculate very much, but we can do it. Okay, so first of all, what do we get out of this? Ideally one would want everything below this line to be in the survival region. Well, we have to focus near this point. And the monotonicity of the parameters is such that, remember, if you increase alpha 0, you increase, you make it more likely for 1s. 1s are happier. And so, in fact, this really is monotone this way. And it's also better if you decrease the alpha 1. Okay, and so what we get is this little curve near 1-1, and it would have been nice if this were just a neighborhood, you know, an open disk intersected with the region below the line. It didn't quite work that way, and I can put up a formal statement, but basically it's just simply this. If you take a line with a larger slope than M0, for instance, this one, and you take a line with a smaller slope like this one, then there is an open neighborhood in there for which you get survival. But we can't control how big it is as the line comes up to the right slope. And so you get some sort of, I mean, this kind of comes in tangentially as far as we know. Let's see. Well, this is the voter model. This stuff, this yeah, okay. This is where the ones dominated. I haven't drawn the region where the zeros dominated.
So that's the same line you had before.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, this is... Well, you know, I'm not very good at drawing these pictures. And in order to see something at all, and I didn't get you to see very much, I had to adjust the slopes. But so it's not the same slopes as the picture before, but... Right, right, that's right. So, that's right. Maybe it's a little more clear in the next thing. Okay. The fact that this line has slope less than one is good because if you interchange the role of zeros and ones, you flip alpha zero and alpha one, and that means that you have survival of the zeros in, flip this over the diagonal. So there's a common region where both survive. And because we compare against oriented percolation, the facts that both types survive in this strong sense mean that they coexist. And so here, here it makes it clear. There's this tiny little, well, okay. this upper part of this was the our new survival region, this tiny bit. You flip it up the diagonal, you get survival for the zeros, and in fact, you get coexistence in there. It's some non-empty region. We don't know how big it is. But that is a new area of coexistence because all of this, except for down here, was unknown, and there weren't any coexistence results away from the voter model or away from 0-0. Okay. Unfortunately, this doesn't work in two dimensions because the line that we get has slope 1, so again, we have this you know, little bit of improvement. Here I've made it look bigger. But this little extra region here of survival. But now, if we flip it over the diagonal, we get a region where the zero survive, but there's no intersection. So we can't do what we did before. So we don't know. So we have no coexistence result for this, for two dimensions. Okay, these are just all the epsilons and deltas to make those statements rigorous. But the pictures is what it is. Okay. Is our approach just completely artificial? Do the answers we get have anything to do with the real conditions for the model? Okay. Well, there you can define a curve that is at the top of the survival region, say H of alpha naught. Oh, they weren't supposed to both go up. And we have what amounts to an upper bound on the slope that this thing can go into, 1, 1, 1. And in fact, it turns out that, although this is not by any means written up, but we're pretty sure everything works, we can get a bound the other side. So let me put up a transparency which will make the statement more clear. But the conclusion is, in fact, that the survival region does look like this line of slope M0 as you go into the point 1, 1. So it's not an our numbers are not artificial, they are correct at infinitesimally at the point 1, 1. Okay, so let me give you a picture like this. I shouldn't have put this thing down. I might. Let's just move. Okay. Maybe you can. Well, for a minute, just look at the top. So alpha 0 is still the horizontal, alpha 1 is the vertical, and now I'm just drawing it near the point 1, 1. The survival region, at least near 1, 1, the survival probability is monotone, so that you really do have some kind of curve. Who knows what happens on the curve, but below the curve there's survival, above the curve there isn't. And what we can so in effect our results show that this curve comes in at a slope which is at least M0, because we get we get survival along any line with slope less than this. And so the complement to this is the to try to show that here I didn't put the region in, that if you take a line above this that is a smaller slope, that you're going to have, well, I wrote extinction, but not survival if you're above it. And so again, you get one of these kind of tangential regions, but this this does show that the survival region near the point 1, 1 is identified, at least in terms of the slope, by these numbers, M0 and by M0. Let's see. Thank you. All right, let me tell you what these constants are that come into the limiting super Brownian motion parameters. At this point, it doesn't matter where they occur, but they do come in. And they are coalescing random walk probabilities. So here you start random walks off at, say, on the top, three different places. And that picture is the probability that the walk starting at zero avoids forever the walk starting from these two other points, E and E prime. And the walks starting from E and E prime coalesce, they meet. Okay, so time is going backwards, t or downwards, t equals zero is the top. The dotted line is t equals infinity. So, and then you have to sum against the kernel. So that's one of the parameters. And the other parameter is something similar. It adds the probability that the walks never meet. Coalescing random walk is the dual of the Vodor model, so it, in principle, it's not surprising that these things, something comes in involving coalescing random walks because you're close to the Vodor model. You have to see the details. The two-dimensional result, the picture, okay, for the two-dimensional picture, of course, all the walks have to meet. So this degenerates, and in fact, it's not the right answer anyways. The fact that there is an extra log n in the mass scaling in two dimensions really makes life difficult. And that line t equals infinity was really t equals n. And for transient random walks, you run them for a large time n, that's about the same as running them forever. For two dimensions, that's not the case. And so what we have to prove is that the similar probabilities, which are now going to zero because the walks have to meet, when multiplied by log n, behave. And in the top, we get convergence to something which is not zero. And in the bottom, you're imposing more restrictions on the random walks, that they all avoid each other. And so that probability goes to zero. This was an extra factor in the gammas. And since the zero, this makes the gammas equal, and that makes the slope 1. Here's an open question. I don't know that it's important, but I think it's kind of fun to think about. And there are some conjectures. What's the right normalization to put here to get something not zero? What's the real order of the probability that three random walks, nearest neighbor, start at three different points, that they avoid each other for time n? In order to do this, we wind up showing that it's at least as big as log n to the 3 halves. There's some conjecture that it might even be log n cubed, because there are three pairs. The random walks get far apart. They sort of act independently on appropriate time scales. Anyway, it's I think an interesting question, but we don't need to know the answer for our purposes. Okay. Well, this may be a little risky, but I'll try to point out why these numbers are relevant, why these probabilities are relevant, and I want to look at the probability that I have a 1 and a 0 and a 0 next to each other at time S in the Lotka-Volterra model. Why would I want to do that? Well, in the dynamics, there was a term that said if you were a 1, you multiply by the density of 0 squared. So that's having two zeros around you summed over the sites. So that's something that's sitting there in the generator and comes out when you look at anything. And it happens to come out in the what is eventually the growth parameter. But it's certainly there in the generator. It's got to appear somewhere. And so what is that probability? Well, you can construct these things in the usual graphical Poisson processes way, if you've seen that. You can, and you try to follow these paths backwards in time, and I want to follow them back a time epsilon, but this is rescaled time. So for the random walks, S is really Sn. S is really Sn, and S minus epsilon is S minus epsilon n. Okay. Now, if epsilon is small, if you follow these paths, what do they do? Well, the voter mechanism is acting at a fast rate. This extra nonlinear part with the squares is acting at a small rate. And in fact, a small but bounded rate. So if epsilon is small, you won't see them. The probability is that you won't have one of these, what I would call nonlinear interactions in a small amount of time. So what do you have to do to have a 1 and a 0 and a 0 up there? Well, the 1's got to find its way back to a 1 at time, some earlier time. And the zeros, when you come backwards in time, they may or may not meet. I've drawn it as they meet. But the backward path, if there are no nonlinear interactions, are just random walk paths. Okay. Okay, so that was just the probability of no non-voter transition is small. And the probability of that picture is either gamma 1 or gamma 0, provided that epsilon isn't too small. We have to have epsilon both small and not too small, because this is rescale time, so if epsilon n is even log n, it doesn't matter, then the probability that they avoid each other for that amount of time is essentially doing it for infinity. So the probability that these paths do this is given by our coalescing random walk probabilities, and then look at where the random walks land. Rats. And here is where, if the time isn't too small, then on this, remember, space is rescaled here as well. So if the time is not too large, if it's relatively small, then the x and the x prime aren't going to be too far apart. Okay. And I get to ignore the x double prime. I don't care where it lands, because in fact, remember, this is a low-density limit, so there are hardly any of these ones around, actually. There's only of order n in three dimensions when space has volume, you know, n to the 3/2 in it. So you can ignore that, and then that suggests that this term that comes out of the generator, but you have a 1, right, this is right out of the generator, that in fact from that picture may be equal to just you get rid of the square terms, you get rid of everything except just having a one. And that's a term that comes in the generator for super Brownian motion, in the martingale formulation. All right, you have to make this precise. We get L2 estimates, at least in dimensions 3 and above, and all of this works. But this picture is really why these coalescing random walks come into the form of the super Brownian motion. Okay. There are lots of conjectures, lots of open problems. I'll just close with one of them. Let's see if I can go back to one of my. Let's see. Okay. add to the coexistence picture, in particular along the diagonal. Neuhauser and Pakala suggested that there should be coexistence, and after all, there's coexistence down here. And there's coexistence up there, but things are monotone if you change one of the variables at a time. But going up the diagonal is the wrong thing for monotonicity. So how do you connect them? you do have coexistence. And in fact, I almost forgot. I could show you a simulation if it behaves. It's a little cranky at times, but so this is the two-dimensional model, nearest neighbor, and black is 0, green is 1. I'm at the alpha zeros down here are both 0.5, so I'm in the middle of that diagonal, and I'm starting with something like a with 9 or 10 ones in the middle. The only reason to have that many is that it turns out, from simulations anyways, it has a decent chance of getting going. But here's what happens if it works. I haven't done any statistical studies or power law plotting or any of that stuff, but it sure looks like the thing is surviving. It even looks more than that. And here's another open problem. There are shape theorems for particle systems that when they grow, that there's an asymptotic shape, which is typically the unit ball in some norm that you can't specify. Well, it looks a bit lopsided, which may be my random number generator. Maybe that just has to get going larger. But I would bet that there is a shape theorem that you have coexistence, that there's a unique invariant measure which concentrates on both types, and that you have a shape theorem. Inside the shape, you have a slice of the invariant measure. So those are some open problems.